I was telling her seemed so much like a periodic table. And they actually, in the Kabbalistic text, they refer to that quite a bit. My interpretation comes from the Jewish Kabbalistic text, but this is not Jewish because they have a prohibition against using human figures and paintings that had anything to do with the spiritual nature. So what they do is they fill their literature full of descriptions. Now, a lot of it's going to have to do with the human body and stuff like that, because, you know, you get in Christianity these days, especially with Protestantism, you get this idea that, you know, God's this little old man and he has a body like us and everything else. But this really does go back to the book of Genesis, when it says that, you know, man created God in his image, male and female, in his likeness. And that's what this whole mystical system is about. Oh, hi. Come on in and sit down. Thank you. We were just getting started. So basically what you'll get is you'll get the idea that this is only on the major arcana. And let me go ahead. What we will see is with the periodic table, what you'll see with the way the letters are laid out is that the periodic table is arranged in a highly structured order. And that each thing has its own place, and you can't take oxygen over here and substitute it for hydrogen. They all have their own place, and it's based on their atomic weight and atomic number. Now, the difference between that and the 22 letters is that these are based on the fact that they have weight and they occupy space. The 22 letters were actually the forces of creation. But they weren't just the forces of creation, because what sparked creation was God's thought of man and his image. And that's what sparked creation. So the concept of the divine man, or the way man was originally thought of in God's mind, and the creation of the universe are interlinked. That's not what I wanted to do. When did it do that? The invention of the tarot came in about 1430. There's a lot of people that do the card readings. This has nothing to do with readings. Readings actually showed up about 300 years after the cards were invented. And they did show up in Italy, where the cards originated, but they became popular in Paris. The invention of the tarot pack consisted of 22 new picture cards. They were added to an ordinary deck of cards. Now, what's important about this is that 21 of them are considered trump cards. And that's very important when you break it down, because there were only, of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, only 21 of them were actually involved in the act of creation. So the first letter, Aleph, stands outside of all of that, because Aleph is the first letter of the name Achad, which means unity or oneness. So that was associated with oneness. And when we get down and take a look at the tree, I'll show you how that works. But basically, the core cards and the number cards were already around for well over 100 years before they stuck the 22 picture cards in. And then Jemima Duman, this whole group right here, I didn't put the sir there, but he was nice. This guy, he was a professor at Oxford University. He was considered the leading authority on the tarot cards and their origin. Wrote a book called The Game of Tarot, sells for about $900, but he did a lot of the historical work. Ronald Decker is the head of the U.S. U.S. Games, I think it is, but basically he puts out most of the card decks that we see today, his company does, especially with the tarot cards. And then DePaulis is a Frenchman who had won all sorts of accolades in his research on the origins of the tarot cards themselves. Now, what all three of them thought is that the tarot cards were only designed for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is gambling. They gave a whole new twist to gambling, and that for the first 100 years of their existence, that's the only thing that was ever recorded that they were used for. Some of you may know the name of Frances Yates. She was a colleague at Oxford University with Dumont, and she was the one who basically wrote the works on the esoteric movements of the Middle Ages and the medieval period. And she severely criticized him for not taking into consideration that 22 cards may relate somehow to the Hebrew alphabet, but she wrote the corrupted form of the Kabbalah, whereas it's actually the pure form of it.
So you're saying that the throw cards, cards that already existed, were used as trump cards?
The card and number cards were already there. Somebody stuck 22 picture cards in around the 1430s. They showed up in the bars and taverns, you know, were gambling and drinking and stuff going on. But that's a count. I'll account for that in a few minutes. But basically, what he wanted to do because of Yates' criticism is they stuck this little thing in. Their book said that the tarot cards were the most successful propaganda campaign that had ever been invented. They really tore into the cards, and they did such a meticulous job in their research and history that they actually argued over whether or not this guy was born in 1771 or 1772. It's just ridiculous. But they did set the idea, they gave you the definition of where the cards really originated from. Dispelled a lot of the other ideas of the cards coming earlier. Because he showed there was I think Charles V had a deck, or there was one associated with them that would have been in the 1380s in France, but he found out that actually the cards were painted by an artist from Ferrara in about the 1470s. But they stuck this paragraph in there that said the esoteric symbols in no way rules out a deeper level of esoteric symbolism, meaning specialized knowledge not possessed by all the educated people of the time to discern. A surface meaning often exists with another buried beneath it, and that's what I'm going to show you is what's buried beneath these cards. My association with the cards started back in about 69. I took a case deck where you could color them in, but my instructor, he owned an occult bookstore off campus, but he was a retired Catholic priest, and was actually at that time the Archbishop of the Church of Antioch for the Southwest region of the United States. And he laid them out much like I'm going to show you. It's just that he had not found a lot of the significant meanings behind that particular layout that I have come across in my study. I presented my ideas. I took a class in French poet named Gretchen Troyes, and I noted a great similarity between the images and his descriptions of his courtly love tale of Eric and Enid. I presented it to him, and he thought there was enough similarity. He was impressed with my presentation, so he basically pulled me out of my normal studies. Now, he was also a Catholic priest who had been head of the Vatican Library for 5 years, so he was very knowledgeable in it. The problem was the French poet was writing in the 1150s, and the cards didn't show up for about 300 years after that. Now, for the first 100 years of their existence, they were in a quadrilateral area that was defined by the Venice up here, down to Florence and over to Urbino, which is a little town that would be right there, and then back up to Florence. So it was basically just in this one region that the cards were used for the first 100 years of their existence. Now, Dumont and his group decided that The car, let me go back up. The car's probably originated in Ferrara, which is right here, because of Ferrara had their court, their royal court or whatever, they were pretty lively. You know, they like to have a good time, basically. So he thought, well, they're more, these images are more kind of a burlesque, as he referred to it, than anything else. But so he's got the cars coming out of Ferrara. Sometimes that is the first place they were ever noted. So the first documented recording of the tarot cards themselves come from 1443 in Ferrara. Okay, so this is the Visconti deck. Now the Visconti deck comes out of Milan, right here. And the Visconti deck either dates from, it's the most complete and earliest of all the decks. Only two of the major arcana were missing, that would be the Devil and the Tower. But it was routinely expected of the royal families back then to remove those two cards from the deck because they were considered heretical by the Catholic Church. So it'd be real easy to separate them out and lose them. It didn't mean you didn't use them, it just meant you kept them out of sight. So it probably in that period of time, because it was specifically those two cards, somehow they got misplaced, and they're not of the regular deck, but those are the only two that are missing. So let's see, the Visconti's came about somewhere between 1450 and 1463. They dated 1463 because they think he commissioned this artist named Bonificio Bimbo to paint the cards. But most likely the cards were really painted by one of the guilds that he was associated with. There would have also had the Zappavati brothers who painted the images on the side of Duomo in Florence. This right here, this is the Popus. Now, the Popus actually turns out to be one of the Visconti family members. She was referred to as Sister Manfreda. She was a member of the order of what they call the Humiliati. And they were the humble ones. But they were also considered by the Catholic Church great heretics and were tied in with the Waldensians, who were great heretics back at that time as well. Sister Manfreda, a lot of this is what I'm getting. I can't pinpoint the actual people who did this, but I'm getting closer to it, I think. It has to do with something that there was a gentleman who lived 1153-35 to 1202 named Saint Joaquin di Fiore, and he put out this great prophecy based on, let's see if that's the next one. Yeah, there we go. Based on what these are called, the Boromian rings. It's an interesting thing about the Boromian rings because there are three interlinking rings, but you can't join any two of them. You can only do it when you have all three, and then when you have all three, they're inseparable, is the way they describe it. But he used these to prophesize the coming of this new age. Most of these groups, all of these groups that I'm talking about, they were what you would call apocalyptic. They were messianic. They were looking for a new age to come, and a way of bringing heaven down to earth. What you have here, and we're going to see this over and over again, is what they call, referred to as the Tetragrammaton, and that's the four-letter name of God. And for this particular group, it's really the only functioning and working group of that. So you've got the Yod, the He, the Ba, the He. If you spell the name Jesus, it's spelled the same way, except you put a sheen here in the middle, the Hebrew letter sheen, which I'll show you what significance that has when we take a look at the tree. What he had prophesied is that in about the year 1280, there was supposed to be a new age coming on. And that new age was going to be the age of the Holy Spirit. and the Catholic Church itself would be replaced by all women instead of all men. So you know how well that said with the Catholic Church. They weren't real happy about that at all. A lady named Guglielma moved into the Milan area around the 1260s. She was the illegitimate daughter of Otto II, who was the king of Bohemia. But she was actually what you'll see as in the heretical sects, their high priests were called profeti. They could be men or women. Men and women had an equal status, and for a very good reason, besides the obvious one. But for their thinking back there, it also had something to do with the way they pictured them spiritually. So the New Age was supposed to come in around 1280, and Sister Manfreda, Guglielma, picked Sister Manfreda as the new pope, the popess. So this is a picture of her. That thing. A lot of these pictures you'll see in the Visconti dagger actually things are members of the Visconti family are dealing with them. She was burned at the stake in 1300, of course, and along with her, they had dug up the skeleton, the remains of Guglielma, and they had tied her remains to Sister Manfreda, and then they burned them together. They destroyed everything. They burned up all her Guglielma's prophecies and writings. They actually dismantled her grave, pounded the stones and made it into gravel and everything else. But about the same time that the tarot cards showed up, a church was established in this little town on Lake Como that was dedicated to Guglielma, Saint Guglielma, as they called her. And one of the characters that we'll be talking about, Pico della Mirandola, he's considered the father of Christian Kabbalah. And he had a translator named Flavius Mithridates, who translated all his Hebrew texts and everything. Well, Mithridates, who I think was really the force behind Mirandola, actually changed his name to Guglielmo. So it was all about in the same time. And I think the more I've studied the cards, the more I understand or start to understand that they were probably tied into this prophecy somehow. Because even though it was supposed to happen around 1280, when it didn't happen around 1280, all these other people started recalculating his findings or his predictions to try to match it with something else. You say, well, no, he started it too early, he should have dated it from here. The most famous of these people was Isaac Newton. He also, and according to him, the prophecy will come true sometime around in the 2070s. So it's about 50, 60 years from now that we're supposed to see this. According to Isaac Newton, we're supposed to see this new age coming up. And she was actually, crowned the popess. Now, let's see.
New age of all women?
Huh?
New age of all women, are you saying?
What?
New age of all women.
Well, women, the Holy Spirit is the feminine aspect of the Godhead.
Woman pope?
Yeah, woman pope. Okay. Yeah. And women would run the church and everything. Makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, his three ages were the age of the Old Testament, the age of the New Testament, and then the age of the Holy Spirit. So this was supposed to be the last big age coming in. Women were supposed to take it over. Now, I'm going to use the word man through here, but understand when I talk about the word man, I'm talking about it in the biblical context of male and female, okay? Because a real man, according to them, is not a real man unless he's male and female. United as one. The soul, what happened after the fall is that, Eve and Adam noticed their nakedness and they were kicked out of the garden. Well, basically, when you're born into this world, the male aspect comes into this world, whereas the female aspect is exiled, as they refer to it. Basically, what we're really talking about is all of this talks about states of consciousness. So you've got to realize how they picture the world of creation. or the forces of creation, but everything's mental. So every time you're talking about, I'm talking about anything, it's in reference to states of consciousness. So the aware state of consciousness is referred to as the masculine. It has to do with the intellect and reason. And then the exile part is what we refer to as the subconsciousness. You know, you're still aware of it's there, but it seems to be away from you, and it's not something that you can easily access. So the perfect state is where the male and female come together, and you're aware, as much aware of the feminine aspect as you are the masculine. So, and it's through the feminine aspect that you're tied, the Holy Spirit, as they call it, that you're tied into the divine.
Reaction must have been the backlash in the Roman Church.
Oh yeah, this is what sparked the Inquisitions. There were three basic Inquisitions, but this is what sparked the Inquisition. This would have been the third and last Inquisition, which basically was directed against these particular churches and the scientists also at that time, because basically science grew out of what we think of as occult philosophy. But you know, when you say a cult now, everybody thinks demons and all this stuff. And some of that was tied into it, basically, in the hidden forces of creation. You know, the word occult just means hidden. So it doesn't mean something necessarily sinister at all. Let's see.
Gary?
Yeah.
Was Sister Manfreda Pope in the Vatican?
Was Sister Manfreda?
Was
no,
she?
No, she never
where?
Went to the Vatican.
Oh,
she was with the Humiliati. They were trying to start their own church. Now, there was a male portion of it and a female. I mean, a nuns. You know, you had the priests and the monks for the male part of the Humiliati. And they were the ones who were heavily persecuted by the church. The feminine, or the nuns, and the female part of that group of Humiliatis actually just went out of existence back in the 1930s. They had kind of conformed themselves. Oh, hey, Dean, come on.
Hey.
I'm just getting started on it.
Hey, Dee. Hey, Dee, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
Now, you get some, especially Shakespeare does a lot of this. If you'll read his works, he brings in a lot of these political books, and, you know, on a sub-level, Romeo and Juliet are about the fighting that went on in Italy during that time. You had the Montagues and the Capulets, I guess. I'm probably saying that wrong, but one of the groups was heretical and the other one was Christian, and that's why they were fighting with each other, because the Catholic Church had okayed. You could go in and kill anybody you wanted to, and then you could go and buy forgiveness from the church itself. They encouraged it because, you know, they wanted these people out of there, and at the same time, you know, they didn't mind paying a little money to do their dirty work. Now, in my studies, I started tracing some of these things back, because I started in the south with this poet in the south of France, and the one suggestion that my professor, who was a Catholic priest, he said, look at the Albigensians, there may be some link there. And sure enough, there is. The Albigensians were a heretical group that existed right in here in the south of France. The Catholic Church, that was one of the crusades, was against the Albigensians. It was the first time that was Christian against Christian. And they basically went in and wiped all these people out. Most of us nowadays know of these groups, and they're referred to as the Cathars, or Cathars, or whatever. I say it different than most people do, but that's just my taxon. And there are a lot of academics now who say, you know, the Cathars are just a dream or something that was made up in the 1880s by these particular historians, but there's no link, and there was only one group that ever called itself by that name. But these heretical Christian groups did not call themselves anything. All the names that were applied to them were applied by outside people who saw them, or they were either designated by the masters of their group. Now, I happened to pick up this work by Professor Irwin Goodenough. He was a professor at Yale University. He's considered the leading American religious historian of the 20th century. When I went down, I didn't see my professor for about 30 years, and then I went down to present what I had. And I told him about this book. He had three or four books by Goodenough sitting on his shelf, but he had never heard of his work called Jewish Symbols. And that was Goodenough's life work. He spent more than 40 years in field research, going around. The gist of Jewish Symbols is how did Christianity, which started, right over in this area here, by this renegade Jewish sect who were considered way outside even the rabbinical or mainstream Judaism. How could this, if they spoke no Greek, you know, their language was a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. So how in the world could this little sect, in a 50-year period, have major churches all over the Mediterranean and Middle East basin? They were well established by them. And he couldn't figure out how in the world that could have happened in a 50-year period. So what would account for it? Well, what he found out is they were already there, and they'd been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. What had happened during the time of Solomon is that his kingdom was so successful and, so it had flourished so well that these people, this group of Jews, set out and basically moved into all these different areas. And over the hundreds of years, they had, kind of become incorporated into the Hellenistic culture. So they were referred to as Hellenistic Jews. Well, Hellenistic Jews, here's Alexandria. Most of my research that I found this stuff out was from Philo of Alexandria. I believe he was referred to as Philo of Judaeus. But he mentioned in his book on contemplation, and also same as did Justin Martyr, is they're the ones who refer to this large Jewish population. Even though it was scattered everywhere. And he mentioned the fact that they had a central church and they were in touch with each other. Goodenough also noticed that the prophet Ezekiel played a great prominence. But his main thing was that he noticed that in their churches and temples, one, they interchanged symbols. They had as many pagan symbols as they did Jewish and Christian. To the point now, I saw something not too long ago in one of the temples he studied, and they still couldn't decide if this was actually Jewish, Christian, or pagan. But he saw that, and what he also found out that through this whole group, it was just a small select number of symbols that they kept using. It was like each one of them used the same set of symbols all over this area, and they were mixed in with pagan symbols and everything else. So he thought, all his other colleagues said, this is just decoration, much like Newman saying the pictures on the cards are just decorations. They're exoteric symbols, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. But so he said, no, they don't. They have to have some kind of meaning. And he'd go into these churches, and he would read the paintings on the walls, and he noticed that the mosaics or paintings, you could read them. They had an allegorical meaning going. You could look at them horizontally, or you could look at them vertically, and that also tells this allegory that was going on. He accumulated over 13 volumes of material. So you can imagine how difficult that would be to read through all that stuff. So the few individuals who actually read through it, in his introduction, he made a comment that symbols seemed to speak to him. And because he said that, he discredited every bit of his work. They lambasted it, and that's why it's just, even though it's still there and you can access it, Best thing is, I've got this little bitty, I didn't bring it with me, but you can buy a one-volume condensed, abridged volume, whatever. This professor, who was a very good friend of his, who was as heartbroken as good enough was at his death, he mentioned about how his work was never acknowledged or anything, put this book out again just to show people. And I picked it up and read it, and thank goodness it was condensed. But it basically, what he's saying is that this large group of people, they were already there. They were set in place and mixed in with the community. But their emphasis that he could see from what the mosaics were saying played heavily, had heavy prominence on the writings of Ezekiel. And that, they basically were saying, I'll get into that in just a minute. Basically what they were saying, or what he could see the reflection of, that there were three main things they were talking about. And that's purity, which was under the symbol of what we know, or what we don't know of, but what they referred to back then as the Al-Qaeda of all things. We hear Al-Qaeda all the time. Al-Qaeda was the binding of Isaac, for the sacrifice of Isaac. And that it relates to the concept of purity of the soul. Then he found the other aspect was enlightenment. There was a real emphasis in the mosaics on the concept of being enlightened, of seeing the glory of God, as he referred to it. And then the last one was actually union with what they called or referred to as the Logos. And union with the Logos, cleaving with the Logos, cleaving is what they call it. My brother said, well, doesn't that mean cutting? Well, no, this means actually hugging or holding on to, cleaving to. And it's cleaving of the human intellect, male and female, the human intellect, with the divine intellect of the universe. And we know of this as the Tetragrammaton. That's what they were talking about. The yod and the hey are the divine part, the ba and the hey are the human part. And when you know how to pronounce them, they're one. Okay, the divine is made in the human realm is made, and then that's where you have what they would refer to as the overflow. That's when the divine gifts and everything else come down to you, the blessings. That particular group of heretics lived in, they were over here in this area. Now, when Rome marched on in the 60s AD, when Rome marched on the Holy Land and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, then you have the slaughter and Messiah. These groups were actually, they were there in Qumran, what we know of as the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's where they operated out of. They were Merkabah Mystics. Merkabah means working of the chariot, means the chariot. They referred to it as the Ma'asa Merkabah, the workings of the chariot. And that's what you're going to see the tarot cards are, the workings of the chariot. But that's the chariot that took Ezekiel from where he was up to the throne of God, where he had a vision of man sitting on the throne of God. And that's really what this is about. It's basically about how to become your angelic person, how to make or how to reach that divine state, where you're referred to as the divine man, where you're restored to your Adamic state, and you're back to how Adam was set up, male and female. Well, this particular group got run out. And again, you follow them by their names. Well, they went up here and they settled around Babylon, and they stayed in Babylon for, the next 1,000 years, along with the Jews who escaped and went into exile also in Babylon. So they were there mixed together. The way you could identify them, again, is because they spoke Aramaic and Hebrew. they baptized, but the baptism was a substitution for the ritual or the rite of circumcision. And they, what else? Let's see, let's look around. They baptized, oh, and they preached resurrection of the dead, just as the group down here, which you hear Jesus talking about all the time in the Gospels, you know. That was the whole thing, was the resurrection of the dead. So they stayed here. They became known as the Sabians, which meant those who baptized. Now, the Sabians are still in Iraq, but it's a different group. This particular group, in around the year 1000, probably even before that, Persia had come back in and controlled Babylon. And so Zoroaster was set up again as the major religion, and the king or emperor or whatever he was in Babylon drove all the other groups out. Most of the Jewish groups went to Spain, and you see a big influx of them in Spain. But when they got to Spain, there was two groups of them. They were actually already fighting with each other. When you look at the New Testament, you know, Jesus is his group, and then there's the other group of Jews that he, you know, basically are the ones who crucified him.
So this is the forerunners of these Hellenistic groups throughout all.
Well, the Hellenistic groups were already there.
Oh, okay.
And this was the main group, which had a great tie to Alexandria, because Philo even mentions he went over and visited with the royal family. And in Qumran was a perfect reflection of the community. It wasn't just Jewish community. It wasn't just strictly a Jewish community there. They had all the mystery schools were represented in Qumran. But one of the things about the Jewish group that was there, who didn't really necessarily claim themselves so much as being Jewish, again, that was something that was designated to them. They believed they were keeping or had the secret teachings, and they were the ones who were keeping the inner doctrine of the Jewish the Jewish religion. But it was just like a little microcosm of Alexandria. So there were a lot of different groups there. Now, one of the important things about the Jewish group there in Qumran is their main textbook was called the Book of Enoch. And the Book of Enoch's all about the divine man. Enoch was, you know, I think he's in the seventh generation after Adam. Now, so there's your number seven right there. And he walked with God, and he was not. In other words, he went with God. He became an angel. So he was, in essence, the very epitome of the divine man, or the angelic man at that time. After this group got run out, they migrated. I should go back up to the other picture. They migrated from Babylon through here. They were known by different names, and those names came usually by outsiders, and they were in reference either to their teachings or to their masters, because each one of these groups had a central master. Now, the interesting thing about this particular group, when they were in Babylon, is in this group, one of the individuals who came out of the same group of people that probably, certainly, Jesus as well, well, it was Mani, and Manichaeism came from that. So there was a direct link between these particular groups and Manichaeism, which the Cathars were accused of being Manichaeans instead of Christians when they were claiming to be the true Christian church. As they migrated, out of this area into Europe, most of them came this way, but they were, and especially when they settled here in this region, they were known as the Bogomils. The word Bogomil means good men. Okay? The tradition of the good men, you can read, Philo has a story of the good men. The good men were the masters of the different schools in Alexandria, and they would get together at certain festivals and march down the street playing instruments and singing. But there was the tradition of the good men all the way back here, and would have been tied into the groups in Qumran. The Bowden Mills being good men, somewhere again, somewhere in the 1100s, and they were all messianic groups. So their main message was, you know, they were looking for the Messiah, the main teacher who was going to come, and the whole community would be enlightened. And when the community of the world was enlightened, it would rise up. And then, as they describe it in the Zohar, Moses went up to the mountain and God descended to meet him. So Moses went on the mountain, God came down to the mountain. Okay, and then, so that's basically what they're talking about. They're talking about that perfect realm. That's when Moses heard the voice of God talking from the burning bush. And I'll get into the explanation of that in just a few minutes. But somehow, during the 10 and 1100s, there was another messianic movement going on. So the Bowden Mills came over into this part where the Cathars, these different groups of Cathars were living, and somehow seemed to be bringing some kind of message. Well, out of that, during this period of time, the Knights Templars started to come into existence. They were originally formed by 9 kings in the south of France, one of them being William de Champagne. Well, Craikey and Detroitus, who I started out with, was the court jester for Marie de Champagne in the court of William de Champagne. We'll find out as we go along that the court jester for these particular groups was actually their high priest. That's the reason he could talk to the king anyway. They called it the fool's license, because he could say anything he wanted to the king and get away with it. And the reason he could get away with it, he was the man or the woman, because there was as many female high priests as there were male high priests. So you have that. They actually went over to the Holy Land, just the 9 of them, on their way. The story is, on their way, they met with the heads of the Church of the Bowden Mills in Constantinople. I think what happened there, and this is speculation, but in the Dead Sea Scroll, one of the scrolls was a copper scroll. And the copper scroll was a map to where all these treasures had been buried, like the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. But it's just that when people went over later on to look for them, everything was gone. Well, I think they had another copy scroll there that they gave those 9 kings. The 9 kings went into Jerusalem. They were on good terms with the Islamic group that held them in Jerusalem. They were on good terms. They set up on the side of the old stable. And I personally think they dug down and came away with some treasures. Because right after that, in 1133, they held the Council of Troyes, where Craikey came from and lived. And in that, they declared the crusade a complete success, and they kind of disbanded all of that. But right after that, you see, some of you who were at the talk the other night, when Ralph was talking, Steve Bass got up and had the timeline on there. Well, right after that, Gothic architecture showed up out of nowhere, Gothic stained glass. The troubadours showed up, most of whom, as this one particular scholar said, were not really literate enough to be able to construct these very difficult and complex poetry and songs that they made. But somehow they still seem to have that anyway. And the literary tradition of courtly love also came up, and that's what Craikey was known for. He was really the first writer of courtly love. Out of courtly love, our genre, romance, developed. So, and that's what you have going on in this area then. And then the Catholic Church went in and moved against the Albigensians. The slaughter was incredible. The last stronghold that they had was in Montsegur, and According to this writer named Tobias Churton, who did a documentary on the Gnostics for the BBC and has written numerous books on them, he said, and there's other evidence too, that three men, they gave them 2 days to decide what they wanted to do. During our 3 days, you could either surrender or you could fight or, you know, you could starve to death, but they had the place surrounded and they could move in. So three of the members went down the back wall, which was almost, you know, they didn't, the French forces and the forces of the church didn't look at the back because it was such a steep drop that they didn't think anyone could get down. But apparently three men went down. And they made their way all the way to Ferrara, of all places. And supposedly with all these treasures, which really, in essence, would have been scrolls, most likely, of some kind. But they made their way to Ferrara. Again, if we go back up here and look at this area, that you know, not only was, when the cards came out, not only was, and because Doom and them go on like, you know, there was nothing there that could have influenced the cards in any kind of occult way. Well, in that particular area, you had the survivors from the Albigensian Crusades living. They all moved into that area. When the Jews and the Bohemians, I mean, the Sabians, who became the Bohemians and everything else, were forced out of Babylon. Along with those were the Ashkenazi Hasidim, which was a particular sect of Jews who had actually had been in control or had been well established in the prophets, the roles of the prophets and the kings until the Maccabean revolt in 153 BC, when the Maccabeans replaced all of the Hasidim with their own kings and prophets and priests. So the Hasidim marched out of Jerusalem into Ashkenazi, where they established the community of Qumran. So you go back to Qumran again. They were what the Ashkenazis did when they got pushed out is they brought all their teachings into a specific pile to the city of Lucca, which is right next to Florence, which is right in that area. That would have been Merkabah mysticism. Merkabah mysticism was already known because of Picadello, Mirandola, and all of them. There was in Spain, when I talked about the groups going into Spain, they had, when they got there, they were split. There was what they called the theosophist and the prophetic. Now, the prophetic were considered to be heretics. And the theosophists were your rabbis and all the basic Jewish communities, where the prophetic Kabbalists were the ones who studied the Merkabah. Now, they weren't referred to necessarily as Kabbalah. I'm going to get into that right now. Let's see right here. Okay. This is a little hard to see. I had to take a picture with my camera to get it over because I couldn't find this on. This is from the work of Philo Judaeus, Philo of Alexandria, who was a Jew, but he's still considered one of the founders of the Christian church, one of the fathers of the Christian church. The Kabbalah that we know of in Judaism, the academics say that it began somewhere in the 1150s, 1170s, because that's the first time the word Kabbalah was ever used. And of course, you know, Kabbalah means tradition, so I'm not sure if it started at that time, what tradition they could have been referring to, but that there was no tradition established by the way they look at things. The tradition they were talking about, that the Kabbalists, the Jewish mystics were talking about, is Merkabah mysticism. That is what Kabbalah is. And they also gave the Jewish scholars day Kabbalah as starting at that time because the concept and the glyph of the Tree of Life began at that time. Okay, that's when it showed up. Well, Philo has a Tree of Life. This is the Tree of Life. It looks a little different than the one that you'll see in a few minutes. But you got to remember, these groups, these things would have been a great secret for these groups. It's not something that they would go around and talk about. It's pretty nervy of him even to put this out. Like Plato couldn't really write about a lot of what he knew about except secretly. Otherwise, you know, it was a penalty of death if he let these things go. Well, this is what you would call the rectified universe. This is when things are put back together or pre-fall. The tree of life we'll look at had 10 aspects to it. But notice the very top when you got there, you've got your three vertical pillars. The middle pillar here is known as Tohom. In other words, Hom means being, or Om means being. So this is the pillar right here of being. Here is the pillar of, now this is also flip-flopped. So this would be as if you're standing like this. So this would be the right side. When we look at the tree, it's like you're looking at the tree. So what's your right side would be over here instead of on this. But you basically have it. You've got right here, you've got what we will find out is considered the body of the divine man, which are the six lower sephira. So in the top one there, you actually have three. So there's three in that one box on top. Here's six, but in this one right here, this would be Yeso, there's two. So you basically have your kin there. It's just that they're what they call rectified. Because what happened, according to Jewish legend, is that God had two creations. His first creation, he just created the forces. So in other words, the 10 sephiroth that you see, the 10 spheres. And he had no way of connecting them. So when he filled them with his light, they exploded and broke and fell down this way. They fell down. It's like light falling down. And as light fell, it kind of folded on itself. And that's what we call matter. So matter is actually made up of light. And we know now that matter is actually energy, which is light. So what the whole process is, this is the rectified universe. We operate out of the universe of chaos, which is real interesting because the only reference that Newman ever came across in 100 years that had to do with the tarot cards that did not have to do with gambling was from this one poet who had this way of using three cards. He referred to this as chaos. He talked about how this is the poetry of chaos. So, and that again, you'll see that's the operation of rectification. These things would not have been known or out in the open. We have no record of these ones because these people didn't operate like that. The Cathars didn't write down text. As Tristan said, I can't tell you my secret, but I can sing it to you. So where you look is you look into their poetry, you look into their literature, you look into their art, and that's where you'll find their teachings. You're not going to find them written down. They didn't write stuff down. They basically, all of this was along the lines of an old tradition. Now, having this tree exist among the Merkabah groups that we know of, the Cathars, all the way back at the time Jesus was alive, and Philo of Alexandria, whereas the Kabbalistic, the scholars on the Kabbalah now dated to around 11-something, means that this existed among the Cathars before the Jewish groups ever got it, the Jewish mystics ever got it. And sure enough, the gentleman who first wrote the word Kabbalah was a man named Moses of Berbos. And he noted, or it was noted by Gershom Scholem, who's the great scholar on the Kabbalah, that sometime about a year or so before that, he had actually met with the heretical groups. And he came back to his community and said, I have this great secret. And they're saying, you know, he's referring to it as the Kabbalah, and the tree of life shows up all of a sudden. So I firmly believe that these heretical groups had the tree of life long before that. You can find evidence of the tree of life. Most of the scholars, the three main texts in the Kabbalah are the Bahir, the Sefer Bahir, the Sefer Yetzirah, which means the Book of Foundation, Lockyer means book of splendor, for a lack of a better definition. And then you have the Zohar, which was a massive volume. By all of them, by the scholars, are dated. I think the earliest is the Sefer Yetzirah, and they put it around 650 A.D. But you can find evidence way before that. And the one Jewish scholar that I always operate out of is a gentleman named Aryeh Kaplan. And he even believed that the Sefer Yetzirah, from which golems are supposedly being, you can find out what created a golem from that, actually went back all the way to the time of Abraham. And Abraham is the one who's credited with writing the book himself. Now, who knows? It's good enough. He has one of these wonderful lines where he says, you know, who can tell the birth of an idea? I mean, how do you figure out where an idea is actually originated from? Yes, Mike?
I'm trying to connect these things.
Okay.
Here.
And
are you saying that the tarot,
yeah,
what's underneath philosophically, whatever, theologically, everything, goes back to the Kabbalah?
Well, it goes back to the Kabbalah, it goes back further than that.
So that's underneath the whole thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's how come I use the Kabbalah.
That's the foundation.
To explain all of this. What Kaplan said, he said when you read these Kabbalistic texts, what the Kabbalists did, or what the Jewish mystics did, is probably a better way to define it, is they took all their teachings and they dissembled them and hid them in all these different texts. And so when you read the text, you have to go back, and as he said, you have to like thread them together. Well, what you'll see is that my particular layout of the Tarot brings them all together. I consider this a major work on the Tarot. It's a major work on the prophetic Kabbalah itself, because it will lay it out. Plus, you'll see that this is also a practical system, because I'm firmly convinced, because he says this tying in so well to the cards, that they used it as a memory system and a meditative system back then, where they would actually envision the 22 letters. And I'll show you how they operate. So they would use them like that, but they would also use them to store information so that they could recall it. Now, you can get a general idea. Here's what we know of this tree of life. This is the rectified. So right here, you have these two together. And this is the main act that we're going to be talking about or looking about in the Kabbalah, in the Tarot, is this act right here. And that's called the rectification of Yesod. This one up here is Kether. Kether means the crown. Chokhmah is wisdom. Now, these are the three mentalities. In other words, the divine aspect. So this is Chokhmah. This would be the main yod. This is Bina. She's understanding. Now, the highest of human intellect can reach up into this is Bina. And she basically, what the word really means is intuitive understanding. It's your intuition that's working there. And then you have Chesed, mercy. Gevura, which is severity or judgment. Tiferet, this is the one we're really going to be looking at a lot, because that means beauty. Here's Netzach, which is, I think, victory. Hod is splendor or understanding. Yeso means foundation, so that would be the foundation. This of creation and of the souls that are born into Malkuth, which is the kingdom. And the kingdom is the feminine aspect. Now, as you go up the tree, anything that is above another sphere is considered. So this is masculine, this is feminine. This is masculine, this would be feminine. This is masculine, this would be feminine. You have to know how to read that, especially when you look at books. One of their major text would be the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And in there, it's always the female looking for her lover. Well, that means the soul looking for these divine aspects of your heart. She's considered to be the mother. This is the daughter. This is the son. This is the father. Now, the divine man actually takes up six Sephiroth, which constitutes space. This is, when we look at my layout, this would be the tier or the realm of the solar being. This is time, when the male and female aspects, when the yod and vav, the yod and hey, separated, that's what created time. When they come back together, that's the end of time. And then the left pillar here is considered to be the pillar of time. When you've got being or soul, time, and space. I'm sorry, space is whatever it was in. Okay. Now, the project is in creation, when God created, his first creation, he just created the Sephiroth. Okay? The second creation was done by the thought of man, male, and female. And that's when we get the letters coming in. Because what the divine man or the birth of man into the cosmos, what he represents is relationship. He brings in a relationship. In other words, these different separated aspects can start to understand each other. And it's all through what they call a process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And the synthesis comes through the middle of the soul. Okay. I want to read, this is Goodenough's interpretation. So, Goodenough's allegorical interpretation of the mosaic esoteric expressions will identify this congregation to be related to the Mahasa. So he says, as I explain the three large scenes, this is in the Temple of Dura, which is located in northern Israel at this time. The first seems to me to be the Al-Qaeda, as the atoning sacrifice of Abraham and Isaac, by which Abraham became the priest forever after the manner of Melchizedek. Now, you'll see reflected in the cards, they bring in the order of Melchizedek, which identifies them with this particular group. This corresponds to the first step in mysticism of the Philosophia Perennis, purgation, or purging or cleaning. Now, kathar means, it means purgation. They refer to it as the pure one, but it actually comes from the Greek word for laxative. Cleansing of the bowels, a cleansing of the body. In the second panel, one goes up to the illumination of the heavens, that'll be enlightenment. And the third one comes to the implements of the revealed cult of Judaism, the whole properly veiled, but here shown with the veil drawn back to allow what was behind the veil to appear. It's no coincidence, I believe, that the higher mystery had its chief symbol for Philo in what lie behind the veil in the Holy of Holies. But here the most sacred symbol of all is implied, the Torah behind the closed door of the Torah shrine. Here is the third stage of mysticism, which was possible, that of unification. That means the same thing as cleaving. The Prisca Theologia, now this is how, we probably should take that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for coming. And I'll pick this up real quick, because I still got to explain the card. That won't take us so long. I just thought y'all might be interested in the history behind all of this. These particular groups of cathars, they were inclusive. In other words, the only thing that you had your master, you could study any kind of teachings you wanted to. The teachings didn't make any difference as long as you held to the practice of purity, enlightenment, and perfection, which are disciplines and practices that you'll see. Garth Fowler, who did a book on the Egyptian Hermes, he once more described the hermetic path to be catharsis or purgation, illumination and perfection, which is held to be the wedding of the soul with the divine mind, or the logos is how they refer to it. Mirandola's German discipline, of Christian Kabbalah, Johann Rischmann, who is likewise considered as Pico to be one of the founding fathers of Christian theology, reiterates the connection of the three workings of the cherubic life, and we'll get to that, and the priest of theologian by attributing these teachings to Pythagoras, the first philosopher. In turn, Richland identified this great master magician as a student of the Hebrew and Egyptian wisdom. They believe that the Jewish Kabbalists believe that Pythagoras studied with Jeremiah, and that Jeremiah is the one who imparted with him all his knowledge. But he wrote that what, and this is Richland's writing from his Art of Kabbalah, what I ask you, could those three things be that Pythagoras marked out, which put us on the track to the divine, purification, enlightenment, and perfection? Once again, we see that now. Here, the Ashkenazi Hasidim. Okay, I talked to you about the groups of Cathars, the Jewish groups who moved out and assimilated into the Hellenistic culture. Well, the Ashkenazi Hasidim, they were the ones who stayed behind, and they were isolated. And so when they moved into Europe, they stayed isolated for the most part. Then eventually they became known as the Hasidics we have today. But in these particular groups, well, first of all, tikkun, which means purification or restoration of balance, kavod, which means glory or enlightenment, and devakut, which means cleaving or uniting, are those same operations of the cherubim, purity, enlightenment, and perfection. So this is exactly the same thing we're talking about here. So this group showed the same kind of practices as did the Cathars. And they moved, and when they moved from out of the Holy Land, they landed in Italy and then migrated to the south of France.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Which refers to tikkun, kavod, and devakut?
Tikkun is purity.
Tikkun is purity?
Tikkun is enlightenment, and devakut is perfection. So you see the same thing. It's just that, they were in this little isolated group. Now, anytime y'all would want to take a break, it's fine with me. I thought I would take a break when I get up to the cards, which won't be long. Now, so you have Pico del Mirandola come on to the scene, and he wrote the same called the 900 Theses. A lot of his works were considered heretical. He only lived to be he's one of the great minds, considered to be one of the great minds of the Renaissance. He only lived to the age of 33 when he was poisoned. As soon as Lorenzo de' Medici died, 2 weeks later they killed off Pico and a friend of his because the Catholic Church had a lot of animosity against this guy. Lorenzo had stepped in and saved his ass many times before. But when he wrote the 900 Theses, it was to show how all religions are really saying one thing. And of course the Catholic Church objected to a couple of them, and then he wrote an apology and a defense of it, and then they said all of them were radical. But in what he did is he said, I'm going to, I'll go and I'll debate anybody in the Piazza Navona, on January 1st who wants to come, any of the great Catholic scholars that could come and debate me on this. And he wrote an oration to introduce or open up the debate. And this is from that oration. But he said, let us consider the Apostle Paul, the chosen vessel, as to what he saw the host of cherubim doing when he himself was exalted to the third heaven. Okay, now let me show you what the third heaven is. One heaven, two heaven, three heavens. Okay, this is water. These are the three elements. This is water, this is air, this is fire. And fire is in the divine realm, it's associated. So when you hear in the Bible of the burning bush who says, I am that I am, that puts out the tetragrammaton. Well, this is the bush. This is the tree of life. This is the fire, the burning bush. She's considered the inner glory, and the inner glory is the voice of God. So there you have the burning bush. You've got the tetragrammaton right there, and then you have the voice of God speaking from the burning bush. Okay, let's get back to this real quick. Okay, then he says, was himself exalted to the third heaven. He will answer according to the interpretation of Dionysus. And he's talking about the cherubim. And he saw the cherubim being purified, been illuminated and perfected. Let us therefore emulate the cherubic way of life on earth. Now, in Merkabah mysticism is all about the letters. Okay, and it's letter combination, letter permutation, and divine names. Okay, so starting out with one of the operations, there's three major operations. There's Tamura, which is the substitution of one letter for another. Then there is Natarakan, which is one letter standing for a whole word or phrase. We get a lot of that these days in texting. Okay, you know, LOL. Okay, those are three different letters, but they stand for three different words. That's basically the same thing. And then you have Gematria, because every letter in the Hebrew alphabet, because they didn't have a number system back then, they had each letter represented a number. So what you would do in Gematria is you would break the word down into its its numerical value. You would, you know, add each letter together and come up with a sum. And sums of words that had another word with the same sum, that they were identical concepts. That they were talking about the same thing. Well, the word cherub in Hebrew and the word merkabah in Hebrew are made up of the same letters in different combinations. So basically, when he's talking about the cherubic life, he's talking about merkabah mysticism. You say we need to live. Because Topeka, as he said many times, Kabbalah is more Christian than Jewish. So what I firmly believe is when we look at the tarot cards here, we're going to see the original Christianity, the keys to the kingdom of Satan. Okay. And we can skip this. This is about the church. And in the church, they had it, again, like I said, they worked through metaphor and allegory and everything else. So you had a group that on the outside of the church, they were called the auditors in the Church of the Cathars. And that meant the listeners. They were the ones who heard it. So they were just taking it in. So they would actually still be outside the main church. Then the next group was the credentes, or the believers. And those were the ones who could start to interpret or understand what the allegories and metaphors were talking about. Mm-hmm. And then the perfecti were those who actually had gone behind the veil. And that's what that little pulpit, I thought it very interesting that, because by that time, a lot of the heretical groups had already been pretty much massacred and out of the way. But I thought it was very interesting that Pico, of all people, had a description of the way the church operated. Now, what comes up next is what they call the seven pillars of foundation. These are the operating principles. This would be like the laws of the universe to us, you know, that we consider like that. But there's seven main principles that they operate by. The first one is the principle of thought, and that's thought is the beginning of all. I mean, everything happened. God created the universe with the thought. The backdrop of the cosmos is consciousness. And this is all about the different states of consciousness. The tree of life is known as the 32 paths of consciousness. And what's interesting about that with the troubadours, if they would have looked at right after the Albigensian Crusade, the troubadours disappeared. But somehow they want to tie the troubadours back in with the Muslim Sufis and everything, which is basically the same religion as Merkabah. They are one and the same thing. Sufism is all about divine letters, letter combinations, letter permutations, and divine names and the divine name. That's exactly what it's about. So, and the Sufis existed long before Islam came in. In fact, and they still are today by a lot of the Islamic groups as being outsiders or heretical to Muslim thought. So the thought is the beginning of all.
Right?
Yes.
What is Vayehi 2:46b?
That's one of the Kabbalistic, and this is from, these are the books of the Zohar, and that's where you would find this particular passage. I try to support it. Basically, I have little of my own thought, mine's more of a facilitator, trying to bring it together, trying to unite all these things. Where I did that is when I figured out how the cards laid out. And once I figured out how the cards laid out, it was like all this stuff just went in. And I filed these under the particular card. So it's almost like I've set up a memory system, but I have to read it to remember it. So I guess that really doesn't count. So now, we'll get into why it was, what memory actually meant that. Now, here's the principle of correspondence. We know of it as above, so below, as below, so above, after the miracle of the one thing. But the tradition teaches us that when God created the world, he created the lower world after the pattern of the upper world, the divine world, and made the two the counterparts of each other so that his glory is both on high and below. And we'll see this throughout. We'll see both. Oh, another interesting thing, hold on a second, about the concept of consciousness is that the troubadour is always saying to my faraway princes, or they use this particular word in general to refer to this great love that they had, this unattainable love they had. Well, that word comes from the root of the word in Hebrew for consciousness. So, no one, as far as I know, besides myself has figured that out.
What are you saying the word in Hebrew is for consciousness?
Consciousness. Well, I have it. It's something like shekel. And that's the Hebrew word. Shekel means consciousness in Hebrew. And that's the word that they use in the Sefer Yetzirah as the word for, the 32 paths of consciousness. But that's the same word they refer to as the great lady in the troubadour singing. Okay, and the next one is the principle of dignity. And this is really the principle of gender. The male and female, he created them, made known the high dignity of man, the mystic origin of his creation. Now remember Pico's address, his oration that he was going to give in defense of his 900 theses was called On the Dignity of Man. And there you have it right here. This is what he's talking about. And here you have right and left hand. Okay, that basically refers very much to the pillars of the tree of life that we were showing. So you have the right hand and the left hand. These are the instruments by means of which qualities are exercised. Then you have the guide to the Zohar. This is also, so I just wanted to show you this is not just my own thing. This is by Alan Green. Since there was a fascination with the conjugal mysteries reflected in the joining together of the male and female that overwhelmed all symbolic interest. The uniting of the male sixth and ninth several, that's beauty and foundation that I showed you. Beauty is the one, the sixth several is the one that refers directly to the divine man. And remember in Steve Bass's, he showed the cathedral at Chartres and showed how it forms cube, and it said that cube is the divine man. That's the symbol of the divine man that the cathedral itself reflected, which would have been Jesus in the womb of Mary. The uniting of the sixth male and ninth Sephiroth with the female feminine tenth became the chief and in some places the most unique object of concern in the way of explaining the religious life as a whole. So this was a very important concept in Judaism. You have the pillar of judgment, no causality without similarity between cause and effect. And then you have pillar of harmony, the most important realization of peace or harmony is the reconciliation between the ultimate pair of opposites. Because again, this is all about synthesis. Antithesis, synthesis. This is the operation that's going on. And the synthesizing force of all of that is the human intellect. And this is the last of the seven. This is a very important one. Vocalization of the point. This refers basically to the pronunciation of the words into the vowel points. We're going to just be looking at the letters that are considered the consonants of the Hebrew alphabet. We also had vowel points. The consonants were considered the body, and the vowel points were considered the soul that gave the consonants life. Because without the vowels, the consonants could not be pronounced. That's the other important thing about Christianity. The tetragrammaton is unpronounceable, so you have the word Adonai to take its place. But when you put the sheen between the yod-heh and the vav-heh, it becomes pronounceable. So Jesus was the realization of the tetragrammaton because his name could be pronounced. He was the fulfillment of that here because it could be vocalized. When you examine the Greeks closely, you will find that thought, the single point, understanding, voice, and utterance are all one and the same, and that there is no separation between them. That is what is meant by the Lord is one and his name is one. Now, again, you got correspondence, one above, one below.
Excuse me, guys.
Yes.
When this was written?
When was this written? Well, that's a very good question. Most Jewish scholars will tell you it was written by Moses dealing on around 1240. Mm-hmm. But it is this huge, massive volume. It's got over 50,000 pages to it. And he always claimed that he was just translating.
Because I'm just reading a book on science. Basically like about neurons, and there's an Indian Dr. Ramachandran. He's a very important neurologist, and he writes, he's in California, he writes like how words came into existence, and he sees many, so even Chomsky, Noam Chomsky says like how it came through so much neuron structures and inside the body, and somehow that evolved. They have many ideas. There is Wallace, one guy, he's Irish, he says, and the very few people say how words came into existence. And he comes with an idea, Ramachandran, which is something similar to this.
It's
so fascinating, really.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the gentlemen who lectures quite often, Scott Olson, he does it all on the golden section, mm-hmm. the sacred geometry and everything else. And I can't help but think there's another layer behind all this. R.E.A. Kaplan, who did a lot of the translations mm-hmm. of these Kabbalistic the texts, who I put my faith in, they told Hartley, if it wasn't for him, I never would have understood what they were talking about. But he was a nuclear physicist, and he stopped his profession as a physicist and came in and started translating these texts because he was convinced that they had a practical system on physics that they could actually use, and that they were tapping into that. But quantum physics moves more and more back to the concept that the universe is a great mind, not a great machine, a great mind. It's real funny that we always refer to the universe that's a great machine as Newtonian, where the truth of the matter is Newton was a Kabbalist, he was an alchemist, you know, and that would have been the last thing that he would have ever perceived. He said that he got the idea of gravity when an apple hit him on the head. Well, the apple is the symbol of the soul. So, and the grove, the apple groves, that's a collection of ideas of teachings. And one of the apples fell and hit him on the head. Well, that just means that he had the realization that came to him. Einstein was on a bus one day when the concept of E equals MC squared came. And he went down and wrote it down. And this is exactly what you'll see out of this. This is a means to tap into all of that. And you know, you see these channels on TV where they're talking about, I think this was on ancient aliens, and they were convinced that Einstein somehow had gotten this alien technology that through, you know, meditation he could tap into these higher things. Well, you don't need aliens to do that. You've got yourselves. Okay, now this is the definition from Richland of what Kabbalah is. Kabbalah is a matter of divine revelation handed down to further the contemplation of distinct forms in God. Contemplation, the contemplation is considered salvation. In other words, if you're on the path, you're saved. If you're just working on it, you're saved. And the receiving of this through symbols. Kabbalah is a symbolic religion. It's all about the symbols. With them, so many of them, though, they couldn't use human forms, so they could use words, and that's how come I can tap into so much of this. Okay, let's go quickly. The vision of Ezekiel asks for the likeness of their faces. They had four faces: the face of man, the face of the lion on the right side. They four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they had the face of an eagle. Now I'll show you where those four faces are in all of this. Okay, so we go into creation. Okay, when this is there's two aspects of creation. This is the above. Below. Okay. The cosmos is the macrocosm, man is the microcosm. So when the Holy One, blessed be, he created the world, he did so by means of the power of the secret letters. The letters were shaken about before him, and he created the world by the tracing of the holy name, the tetragrammaton. The letters presented themselves for participation in the world of creation in a variety of permutations. And we'll see that as we go. Certain letters, this is man, certain letters materialize within a measured outline, and the mystery of Adam was formed and shaped in them. These letters have proceeded in a direct line in their proper order. This is very important. Like the periodic table, this is a highly structured. Now, it's not only highly structured just because it's a reflection of creation, but as a memory system. You have to have everything just in place and you remember it just that way. And that's part of being able to bring up all that is contained within those particular sections through memory. It has to be in that order. If you take it in random order, you're not going to figure any of it out or you won't be able to tackle so well. So let's get on here. Here's the letters. And as Rabbi Dinkatilia once said, everything is dependent on the letters. All creation is dependent. Because when God spoke the word, let there be light, he did so with the letters of the alphabet, the sacred alphabet. So you get your number associations here. For sake of time, I'll skip over some of it. Just let you take a look at them. Because we'll go over each one as we go over the card. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the card. What I really want you to do to see how in the Sefer Yetzirah, it tells you that you study the cards by looking at their number. That means the way the number itself is written, but everything that pertains to that. You look at the letter and the way it's written and everything that pertains to that. Then you look at its number, then you look at its communication. In memory system, they ask you how it works is through place. So you imagine a place, you imagine a figure or an image in that place, and then it has some kind of action that's going on. So you'll see that that it's exactly what's reflected in the cards. Let's see, let me get down a little bit, because there's a particular quote. Now, these are the 30, it's referred to as the heart. We see it quite often in Christianity as the sacred heart. Again, a sacred heart denotes bina, intuitive understanding, is the heart of the divine man. Okay? And she's also associated with fire. So when you see, and I have a picture of it coming up, when you see Jesus with a sacred heart and the flame on top, they're talking about the path of the 32 paths of creation, the 10 sephiroth and the 22 letters. The letters, now in creation, what the letters are is that relationship. That's man. That's the outline of man, and it's also the outline of the cosmos. Luria's teachings. Now, Isaac of Luria was considered to be the greatest of all the Kabbalists. The Hasidics followed his teachings for many years, and then they moved away from it. Because sometime in the 1600s, there was this gentleman named the Bhakti Zivi, who came in and claimed to be the Messiah, and most of the Jews in Western Europe and Eastern Europe put their faith behind the man. Which is really strange, because what he would do is he'd go out and have these drunken orgies that would last weeks, where he'd just get completely out of his mind and have hot and dirty sex all over the place and everything else. And then he had come back to his, as they said, his senses, and he'd tell his disciple everything that he saw, and they'd write it down. Well, for some reason, all these people thought he was the Messiah, until the Ottomans got a hold of him and said, well, we're either going to execute you or you can change to Islam. And he converted to Islam, and it all fell apart. But that's the very reason why, for over 350 years, no one really talked about the Kabbalah anymore. And Goodenough used to remark how his Jewish students had never even heard of it. It was pretty much banned by the rabbinical system, because it was just too controversial. And Hasidism, that we know today, is basically the same thing, but they took out the messianic part of it. In other words, that urge that this was something that was coming along immediately. And they just kept the values of it. But again, all of those groups that I was talking about, they were all allowed to study and teach anything they wanted to. So that's why you see the great divergence between them. Basically, what he's saying here is that the main concerns are rectification of the tree of life and what he called the supernal anthropos, or the divine man. So that's basically, again, tying this back to the Merkabah mysticism. This is more of an association. We'll go through this as we go through each of the cards. Oh, now, this is the rectification. Okay, so I was reading Kaplan's book on the Sephirot here. And he said that, so right here, this is the divine man. This is space right in here. Right? He's sick to make the divine man. This is his bride, Velkuth, the kingdom. That's his bride. So, here's his head up here. This is where his head would be placed. But when he's ready to have intercourse with Malkuth, with his bride, his head becomes reversed and he's hung upside down. And that's who the divine man. Notice, right here, the scaffold is the letter Ha, which connects Yeso and Malkuth, the divine man with the bride. So that, and this is what started to pull it in for me. Once I saw that, I realized that all these other things related to different aspects of the cards, and that they could all be pulled into one.
It's the same drawing.
Okay.
Kingdom.
Yeah, that's what her name means, Malkuth. Now, when they're talking about her as the bride, they may call her Nikiba. But basically, Malkuth, the kingdom, is the bride of the divine man. We live, our consciousness is Malkuth. Okay, that's what they're talking. This is human consciousness. This is our divine consciousness, our higher consciousness, and then this would be our divine consciousness here. They'll be talking, yes.
And visually, the same diagram can fit on the hand man.
Yes,
see,
you can bring it over and you will see that.
Yeah, the two hands is these two parts, and the head is the bottom part, and the whole drawing fits there.
Yeah, and Merkabah mysticism is what they consider, what they would refer to as prophetic Kabbalah. This is where the prophets came from. Now, you got to understand that prophetic doesn't mean being able to tell the future. Prophetic means that you've had a conversation with your angelic self. That's basically what it really means. It doesn't have, it's just that when you do that sometimes, you have this great awareness that when you come back, you can understand that actions here will result in actions over here. Yes, it does. And what's interesting, because it's called prophetic Kabbalah, if you notice, prophecy, and we'll see it when we look at temperance, prophecy really comes over here and here. It works through them. Mm-hmm. Well, notice this, and it connects the vena.
Yeah.
So here it goes over here, and that's where his leg is. His leg is over there.
Isn't it the same drawing?
That's really good parallel.
There's a couple of things. They said it was named the traitor because Francesco Visconti's father was hung upside down by one foot when he was executed by the church. And they also put banners all over Rome. They hung these banners all over Rome that showed him being hung by one foot, and they stuck on the name traitor. I personally think it has to do more with something like Prometheus. that he's found the secrets of the gods, the secrets of fire that he's going to bring back to man. And we'll see this. The whole system, really, everything in the system fits together.
Just the hanged man. I can paint that.
Yes. And that's one of the wonderful things I think about the two world cards is because there's so many decks out, but that's exactly how they're supposed to be done. Yeah. I mean, this is all about inside of you and what you can bring out. What you do is you put these images in, you meditate on these images, and they have an effect in themselves that will transform you internally. Let's see. Okay, now the divine man. Again,
Mr. Natural.
We use all these anthropomorphic terms, but don't think that that's. And Guy Cotillia warns his students not to think when I talk about God's hands or eyes that I'm talking about a real eye or a real hand. It's something much more than that. And Mr. Natural, I couldn't help but throw him in. since God wanted to favor us, he created the human body with revealed and concealed organs, which reflects Mahasamirtava. You'll see that in the card. You see the picture, okay? The picture is the communication. That's the revealed organ, okay? The concealed organ, if you notice, none of the cards have a number or letters. So that's the concealed organ. And it's up to you to understand that. So part of this whole thing would be for the initiate to study these and put them together in the proper order. And once he figures that out, then it's like having the doors open for you. That's it was for me at the
bow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you say the number grade before you start the cards?
Yes.
Are you doing the cards now?
No. And actually, are you ready for a break? Because are you guys ready for a
what
short?
What time do we end?
Well, I've got to be out of here by 1:00. So
okay.
Let's take a 5-minute break or so, and then come back in, and I'll get into the cards. The cards should go a lot faster. Like I said, the only thing I'm really going to show you. We'll look at one of the three realms, and I'll show you how it operates kind of as a periodic table, and then how each one of the letters associate. Now, weaving, I've had this picture of Jesus in here, but weaving is, the way they interpret it. I told you when Goodenough looked at the temple paintings and mosaic, he noticed you could read them horizontally or vertically. That's concatenation, and that's what they call weaving. The wolf or the war will be the main streams that bring tightly, that means the fixed order, and then the wolf is where you start to weave it and put it together, and you do so with what they call a shuttle. And we'll see in the cards that the one card that is not a trump is the fool. What we know of as the fool or madman, he sits outside of all of it. He's the shuttle. He's also the letter Aleph, which is unpronounceable, but it makes all the letters pronounceable when he joins them. So let's take a short break then, and when we come back, I'll speed this up. Because I could talk on this for a lot longer, 3 hours. And I will have a book coming out that I delve into all of this, because I've only taken a few passages to try to support what the communication in the pictures show.
And the word Kabbalah, do you know that's the Indian word called Kabbalah?
No, I don't. But
the Sanskrit word Kabbalah means skull. And in Tamil, too, Kabbalah means skull.
Yeah. I think so much of it, because Abraham came from Ur.
Yeah.
And in the Bible, they always talk about the great kings who came to visit.
Correct.
Well, the kings will be the masters. So those would be the masters who came to visit him, and then he took that knowledge and he took it to Tehran and then down into Egypt.
Correct.
I think that's where the Egyptian comes from myself.
Why all these words sort of, they have this Jewish, Muslim, Indian connection. Vayu is also the air.
I personally think the origins come from India and they migrated this way. They just came this way and they were interpreted to different. Oh, thank you, Jerry.
Oh, yeah.